He went further. He urged poor, rapidly industrializing countries such as China to defy the United States and Europe by blocking any agreement in Kyoto that would result in slower economic growth, lost jobs, and a profound and unpleasant impact on the way we live. China and other developing nations might be exempted from the treaty's direct economic costs, but this will not prevent them from being hurt. Their exports will suffer as the economies of industrialized nations slow, so all of us would suffer from these proposals. Moreover, China and other poorer countries had an obligation on behalf of their impoverished citizens to ignore the fears of environmentalists comfortably ensconced in the wealthy West, Raymond argued. The most pressing environmental problems of the developing nations are related to poverty, not global climate change. Addressing these problems will require economic growth, and that will necessitate increasing, not curtailing, the use of fossil fuels. It was extraordinary for the chief executive of a U.S.-headquartered multinational to lobby against a treaty he disliked by appealing to a Chinese communist government, among others, to adopt a negotiating position opposed to a sitting American president. Raymond believed, however, that his obligation as Exxon's chief executive was not primarily to support American diplomacy, and certainly not when he disagreed with its assumptions so profoundly. The Beijing address was seminal, recalled Frank Sproul, a senior Exxon executive who worked closely with Raymond on the climate issue. Exxon's message was that governments should avoid steps that would curtail economic growth. Raymond adamantly believed that Kyoto was both an impractical and an unjust economic agreement. Impractical because it would require the United States to make sacrifices in its national way of life that its people would never undertake. And unfair because it laid so much of the climate policy burden on developing economies whose governments had an urgent moral duty to lift their people out of poverty, which required, in his estimation, burning fossil fuels. Exxon might withstand the financial and business burdens that would likely follow from treaty-imposed limits on greenhouse gas emissions, but Raymond feared that the global economy would slow markedly, and the knock-on effects of reduced growth would hurt the oil industry and the country. He also viscerally resented what he regarded as the fear-mongering of the environmentalist movement. Only by hyping the threat could they justify immediate, even drastic policy intervention. "Just give me a break," Raymond told his colleagues. They had come to the conclusion that the whole debate around global warming was kind of a hoax, said an executive who had direct access to Raymond. Nobody inside Exxon dared question that. China and scores of other poor countries ignored Raymond's pleadings and signed the Kyoto Protocol, along with the United States, in December 1997. 37 industrialized nations, including America, accepted binding targets, although without any enforcement mechanism, that between 2008 and 2012 they would reduce their emissions 5% below 1990 levels. For the first time, almost two decades after the first National Academy of Sciences study had suggested that climate change might be disturbing to policymakers, a regime to control greenhouse gas emissions threatened to impose real costs on industrial corporations like Exxon. Arthur G. Randy Randall III, who served as ExxonMobil's senior environmental advisor in Washington at the time, led climate lobbying for the corporation's K Street team. Randall had earned his doctoral degree in nuclear engineering at the University of Florida in Gainesville. During the 1990s, he had immersed himself in the issues around climate change. A large man, he could be blunt in argument. He was brilliant, an admiring colleague said, but he had a reputation for being pretty aggressive. Lots of people in Washington are very polite in meetings, and Randy is a bull in a china shop. He could talk about climate studies and carbon technology projects the way other people I know talk about the 1986 Red Sox outfield, another colleague recalled. For political cover, Exxon increasingly worked the climate account through the American Petroleum Institute, the industry trade and advocacy group. Randall provided technical expertise, while Raymond offered authority and funds. During the late 1990s, with emphatic support from Exxon, climate became the 800-pound gorilla within the Institute, A really, really big issue, bigger than anything else, a former executive recalled. The oil industry did not want to risk a reduced reliance on petroleum based on provisional science, emerging science, or based upon harmful public policies, as Philip Cooney, an API attorney who worked on climate policy at the time, put it. Lee Raymond took the lead within API, strengthened by the expertise of Exxon's in-house astrophysicist, Brian Flannery. They recognized that if they oiled the opposition to Kyoto in Washington, if they allowed environmental groups to frame the issue as one pitting greedy oil corporations against planet Earth, they would undermine their own interests. To evade direct assaults by environmentalists, Exxon and other API members joined a newly invented and more broadly based group, the Global Climate Coalition, with influential members from every part of the country and many different industries. Exxon and Royal Dutch Shell joined, but so did the Aluminum Association, General Motors, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler. They won endorsements from auto workers concerned that Kyoto would lead to American job losses. During the last years of the Clinton administration, the coalition became the most effective industry association I've ever seen at working to block progress on climate change, Kurt Davies, the research director for Greenpeace, said later. Under Raymond Spur, API also poured money into independent think tanks and advocacy groups that were predisposed to attack Kyoto, or were invented for the purpose by individual anti-Kyoto campaigners aligned with industry. Their strategies emphasized the promotion of free market principles, as the Institute's lawyer, Phil Cooney, later put it.